Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and welcome to the show. My guest this week is Jay Cheel, a filmmaker who's about to premiere his new documentary, How to Build a Time Machine, at the Hot Dogs Festival in Toronto. It's a study of two men driven to recapture their past, one by building a scale replica of the vehicle from George Pal's 1916 movie, and another by unlocking the mysteries of the universe and, theoretically, inventing time travel. The movie makes its world premiere at the Isabel Bader Theater next Monday, May 2nd. Jay picked Superman 3, Richard Lester's sillier, looser 1983 follow-up to the more cosmic-minded movies that brought Superman back to the big screen in 1978 and 1981. It's the one you probably don't think about that often. The one where Clark Kent goes back to Smallville and meets up with Lana Lang, thus missing out on the growing threat from an industrialist, his supercomputer-designing henchman, and, well, some weird kryptonite. It's not perfect, but it has a weird, charming energy and some genuinely sweet performances from Christopher Reeve and Annette O'Toole as Clark and Lana, and of course from Reeve as Superman, who remains the definitive version of that character on the screen. I'm sorry, we all know it's true. I'm really glad I got the chance to revisit it, and Jay had some very savvy insights into Lester's directorial strategies, among other things. This is Someone Else's Movie.
I'm not a huge comic book movie guy. Like, I like them. There are some that I really enjoy. I enjoy Spider-Man 2 a lot.
The Raimi film.
Yeah. And I think I find it's usually when a director's voice finds its way through the noise, I guess, and you can see a stamp on there. And there's something interesting about that happening, someone being able to kind of work their way through the weeds and still have a voice in a big comic book movie. And I guess this is kind of before comic book movies were what they are now.
Oh, so absolutely.
So maybe it wasn't as difficult to, you know, have that voice present in there. But Richard Lester, I always feel like Superman 3 is beat up upon unfairly, and I always feel the need to defend it. And it's more of, and it's not like I have some great argument for it. A lot of it is just I really like it, and I grew up enjoying it, and it was my favorite of the four.
Okay.
And it was before I knew who Richard Lester was. But now it's like there's still this feeling of, I think it has people who have come to appreciate it, but there's still this feeling of its biggest mistake was mixing comedy with superheroes, or comedy with the comic book movie. And to me, that's just so obvious, like the choice of mixing comedy with, like, I'm a big fan of Batman from the, you know, the 1966 Batman. Right. And I just feel like it's not something that should be off limits. And now with Batman versus Superman having just come out.
Yeah.
Even more so, it's like, this is the Superman that I enjoyed, and it's so far away from what Batman versus Superman is.
Oh, yeah.
And the only thing that separates them is that choice of tone, I guess. And I think I can see, you know, I'm not saying Superman 3 is a great film or an amazing film. I can see why people wouldn't like it, but I still think there's value in it, and it's an interesting film in Richard Lester's filmography, because it's a big blockbuster, but I still see his style coming through, and in, I think, unique ways. Like, it's a very entertaining film.
I have to say, I hadn't seen it, I would guess, since the first widescreen DVD release. Uh-huh. So that would be a good 15, 16 years maybe. And I remember I watched it again just yesterday properly, you know. Mm-hmm. On the Blu-ray to see if it was what I remembered. And it isn't exactly. It's got, this time, I mean, I totally understand what you're saying about the lightness of it. And it is the funniest, loosest of the Superman movies, which is strange almost, because some of the comic stuff is courtesy of Richard Pryor, who... I
like this time through, I realized I don't think he's actually playing a character. Like he's right. just making noises for half of his performance, weird yeah. little grunts and
yeah.
and hesitations and half speech, and occasionally shouting things and running around really quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, that's what you got when you got Richard Pryor in the early 80s after yeah. stuff like The Toy and all these other weird choices he was making just to keep working. But there are these long stretches of movie where characters stand and stare at Richard Pryor, and that's not a Superman movie. That's mm-hmm. a Richard Pryor movie kind of invading the DNA of Superman, as right. the Donner films had established. And of course Lester had stepped in to direct Superman 2 after the Sulkins blew up with Donner.
Right.
So this is the film where you get the sense that Richard Lester is making his Superman movie, and it's so completely different in terms of its flavor and timing. Just even the weird insistence that the human relationships aren't terribly important, so they can be a little cartoony, mm-hmm. that actually works for the Silver Age Superman of, you know, the old Kurt Swan days in the 60s when there were imps and aliens and magic powered things happening all the time. It is very much the light Superman movie. And I think now it looks better in the rearview mirror because of Superman 4, which came immediately yeah. afterwards and just is abysmally bad.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that one I do not feel the need to defend.
No. Someone will find him and mm-hmm. throw him into the sun.
Yeah.
So what was your first experience of Superman 3? How old were you when you saw it?
I don't know how old I would have been, but I remember very specifically on the First Choice, the cable
oh, yeah.
channel, when they would have commercials for films that are screening that month or whatever.
Right.
And they had commercials for Superman, and I just remember the shot of the missiles taking off and the shot of those two arms on the supercomputer coming towards Superman with the electricity shooting at him. And that's all I remember. I remember seeing the film eventually. I don't remember having any sort of like feelings towards it, that it was a strange film or a weird entry in the series. I remember enjoying it quite a bit, and it makes sense. It's very colorful. It's one thing I like about it is that it taps into that, and this kind of applies to the film I just made, where it taps into that feeling of watching certain types of visuals that satisfy you, I guess. Like there's that video that was going around on YouTube of the most satisfying video in the world, where it's taffy being spun and, you know, tomatoes being sliced perfectly. And there's just certain images that are satisfying to watch. And I find with Richard Lester in this film, he's managed to pull some images like that, where it's just, he's not only setting up these sort of action sequences or these set pieces, but within them, there are things that as a kid, I remember watching and thinking, psychologically, oh, I liked seeing that, like the bubbling,
the acid. I knew you mentioned the acid. Yeah, and it's soothing in a really weird way, even though yeah, it's something destructive and awful.
Yeah, and that choice, like just to choose to present it that way. It, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a choice, and the way it spurts out and shoots red acid all over the computer, and the way that the wires kind of cross over Superman's face, and the creepy robot when Vera turns into this robot woman.
Jazz singer Annie Ross. It's yeah. such a weird way for her to pop up in cinema anyway. It's,
yeah, the whole film is... the whole film is strange. I mean, Richard Pryor is obviously shoehorned in there for, you know, some sort of value. I guess he had, on Johnny Carson, mentioned he was a Superman fan, so the Salkinds reached out to him and said, be in our film. So I don't think that, although I like Richard Pryor in the film, it's clearly a sort of attempt at pulling in his audience, and which is fine, but...
it's almost like a form of product placement.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Just slotting him into this existing world.
Right. And when the film is talked about as being comedic, it's always in reference to him, that Richard Pryor's in it, and he's shoehorned in, and they're trying to give him all these jokes. And for me, the comedy that I enjoy comes from the direction and the choreography. The opening sequence is I do remember seeing that when I was a kid and thinking that was odd, because you were used to the star field and the big, overly dramatic Superman logo and the music and everything. So it felt like it grounded the movie in a way, but it's still obviously not realistic in any way. But it just feels like it's a smaller story, and it's a more maybe personal story for Superman. You know, he's got this, there's this strange schizophrenic segment in there, sure, where he's, yeah, dealing with his own thing. But that opening sequence as a kid I love, but now, you know, leading up to this, I rewatched a bunch of films, and I rewatched a bunch of Lester films and Jacques Tati films. And of course, Jacques Tati is the person you think of when you see that opening.
Yeah,
it's so just
this elaborate geometric
yeah,
performance piece.
Yeah,
where and every human being and every vehicle and every object is part of this ballet.
Mm-hmm. There's a cause and effect thing going on here where you get that. And for me, I'm not like a huge Superman guy. I didn't read the comics or anything. So defining Superman for me might not be in line with Superman fans, but the idea of humans as these lemmings that if you let them go, they'll get into all of this trouble. Yeah. And Superman's job is to continually monitor them and pick them up. Like there's in that montage at the beginning, there's this scene where, or the moment where the penguins get loose and then the guy's trying to pick them up. And that's Superman. Like it's, yeah, these people walking around falling in holes and, you know, buckets falling.
Cars.
Yeah, and Superman has this job of having to micromanage human existence, and I think that sums that up very well.
Yeah. It's a great image too. Just and the fact that for most of that sequence, he's doing it as Clark.
Yeah,
like he's not able to reveal himself because that would just make things worse or complicate things further.
Yeah,
but to the point where Christopher Reeve can project this incredible, just sort of sweetness of picking up a penguin, blowing out the, yeah, fire on its head and putting it back and sending it back out.
Yeah.
That is, yeah, that's exactly, it's a thesis statement for all of Superman.
Well, you get,
I mean,
this,
assuming that he's not running around killing people like,
right,
he's
these. You get this sense of, it's almost like a parent-child relationship where you want to course correct the child without them realizing you're course correcting,
yeah,
them. So
maybe don't use the claw into the hammer today.
Right. And it's so like the bowling scene when they're out bowling and, mm-hmm, Clark is trying to help the kid bowl. And, you know, he's telling Brad to back off when he's just being too much of a, you know, influence on how this kid bowls and lets him do it. But he still gives it that extra help,
yeah,
without anyone knowing. So it's like he's, as Clark, just, he's got that sort of role where he's helping everyone but making sure he's doing it where it's not like they feel that they need the help. Like he's just kind of sneaking around and making sure everything stays in line. And,
yeah,
and that whole opening sequence I think is cinematically great at representing that, and it's entertaining. And the only mistake is that it's the opening of Superman 3. Like that's the only thing I can think that you could hold against it, is it's unexpected, it seems out of place, and it sets the tone for the rest of the movie, and anyone who's not on board for that will hate the movie throughout. But then, you know, I would suggest try watching, you know, The Bed-Sitting Room, and try watching even The Three Musketeers and all of Lester's earlier films, and settling into that comedic tone and his sensibilities, or Help or Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, I mean, those are the ones that stand out to me. In the,
yeah,
in the, just the management of huge, I mean, just the opening sequence of A Hard Day's Night is a, mm-hmm, chase scene with no,
yeah,
chase. It's,
yeah,
it's avoidance rather than pursuit.
Yeah.
And creates the music video. I mean, it accidentally inspires an entire genre.
Mm-hmm.
And then he continues playing with that throughout his entire career. What surprised me the most about watching it this time was just how technical it is, because I remember, mm-hmm, it as the sloppier film, but I think that's mostly just the way that scenes kind of jam up against each other. The
right,
villain plot barely exists, and now, yeah, of course, 23 years later, the idea that all you need to do is tell a computer what to do in BASIC and you can rule the world is, mm-hmm, a little naive. I mean, it's an incredibly naive vision of IT.
Right, it is, but it's like I'll take that over explaining how that's working. I'll take the naive sort of,
I Wonder punch Woman, it in. I found your email.
Yeah.
Watch these videos now.
We'll just sit for 5 minutes and watch the, you know, these videos. But
yeah.
I'll take that sort of comic book naive early 80s. I just type in a code and it works somehow. And then get that out of the way so we can get back to the fun stuff rather than watching, you know, this sort of tech exposition that I don't care about.
Yeah, and that's absolutely valid, especially in the context of the age where computers were just these weird things that beeped at you and you didn't really know what they were, and no one beyond the technical workers mm-hmm. had any interaction with them. In 1983, computers were cool and fantasies.
Yeah, yeah.
And the idea that's how they would have responded in comic books as well. Just lines up perfectly. I've sketched 3 gum wrappers and a cigarette case, and this is a supercomputer that's more powerful than anything else. I think they say it's 100 times more powerful than any other computer in existence, and that's still not as smart as our phones are now.
Yeah.
So it's all still really kind of gee whiz and childlike.
Mm-hmm.
And people, just a couple of days ago, someone was mentioning it, maybe on another podcast somewhere, that they were freaked out by what happens to Annie Ross at the end, but the robot eyes and that weird robot woman thing, which I saw when I would have been like 14 in 1983,
mm-hmm.
and I had seen the other films, and I just, even then I knew, oh, they don't have an ending. Like, this is just, you know, make the computer a person so he can punch something.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Mm-hmm. But it's also functioning on a primal level that freaks children out, mm-hmm. which means it's succeeding as a Superman movie for the time. Even like the idea that he's having sex and running around being a dick, that's not Superman. It is now, which mm-hmm. is so weird that the bad Superman of Superman 3 prefigures the Henry Cavill version of the character,
right.
who just takes what he wants, kills when he needs to, and doesn't actually worry so much about the morality because he is a Randian superfigure above morality. Thanks, Zack Snyder. But... what you get is, in this, you get a clear sense of moral division, right and wrong. And yeah, he's not quite as godlike as he will become. I think that mostly started in the DC 90s when they resurrected him essentially as a remote god.
Mm-hmm.
So here we still have the innocence and the small-scale moralism that defines Reeve. I mean, Reeve's Superman is the guy who will catch you.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the guy who will make sure, although he kind of tortures Lois in Superman 2. In Superman 3, he's really just not doing any of that. He's being a good person. He wants things that he can't have. What's weird about 3 for me is that it's sort of going over the same essential conflicts as 2, which is that Superman longs to be mortal so he can be with Lois Lane. And once again, he's having that duality, the duel with himself over Lana, kind of, sort of, but it never progresses beyond call me sometime. There's a really weird innocence, as though that's how he's going to present himself to the world as Clark Kent.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's Christopher Reeve, he's still having so much fun with it. Like, it's a playful Clark.
Yeah.
The idea that he can run off and not stand up to bullies because he was busy getting the dog out of a culvert. Superman had to go and save the kid with the head injury. But it also means that he had to move the dog separately because mm-hmm. the dog was with the kid. It's little tiny things that aren't shown but are completely demonstrated in Reeves' performance.
Yeah, and it reminds me of the only thing I like in Superman 4 is the double date, the Clark and Superman double date, where it's almost like a screwball comedy where he has to maintain both dates.
Yeah.
That idea of, again, it gets back to Clark being the one Clark's job is to make sure that people don't realize in what ways they're being helped or maneuvered or manipulated by Superman, so that, you know, you can get to that end point where everybody's safe and sound without sometimes even knowing what happened, I guess. I actually love the whole idea of him returning to Smallville and the idea of, you know, Clark, I think he says he wants to do a piece about this, you know, this socialite now from Metropolis trying to reconnect with his roots in the small town. And meanwhile, Richard Pryor's character, Gus, is doing the opposite. He's mm-hmm. trying to become rich and powerful. So there's a nice sort of, I guess, dynamic there where they're both on these paths to connect with the opposite class or something, and and watching how they go about that is fun. But
yeah, it's a weirdly aspirational narrative for both of them.
Yeah, and the way that when they have the high school reunion and this idea of, you know, high school reunion being classic Americana, and the way it's set up, it's rooted, set in the 60s, and you hear Roll Over Beethoven by the Beatles, which
only Richard
obviously
Lester
Richard Lester license. Can yeah
and all the other songs on the Blu-ray at least seem to have been changed
oh really,
there's this weird artificial kind of, you know, the fake music that plays in the thing instead of Superstitious in the old video version of that. It sounds a lot like that. It sounds like fake library music.
Yeah.
And there's a credit songs by Giorgio Moroder, but I'm pretty sure I didn't hear any in the version I saw last night. But Roll Over Beethoven is still there.
Yeah, and Earth Angel there. Yeah. But either way, the dynamic between Clark and Lana, I love. The way that their conversations never align. They're always stepping over each other's words and misinterpreting what they're saying, and there's this like playfulness amongst them. And classic Richard Lester, I think, is at the top when Lana brings the plates to the DJ and is about to put the salad on the record and stuff like that. It there are little pieces of direction that I think those are the comedic moments that I like in the film, and they're a little goofy. And I think Christopher Reeve said that Lester was always looking for gags to do on the set and put into the film. And I mean, I love visual gags. I love, you know, it's like Just for Laughs, the movie. it's just whether, you know, I guess if people think Superman is gag worthy, I think he is. And so all of that stuff, that playfulness, I enjoy. But it's also the fact that for me, a lot of the modern day superhero films, I just, plot kills me. If there's too much like Red Matter or, you know, the Transformers films, and where we're just getting bogged down in aligning all of these details for a plot purpose, and there's no time, and you've got a 2.5 hour runtime, and we've hardly spent any time with the characters. And so I think with Superman 3, I'm in favor of setting aside some of the details of the villain's plan and you know, the more plot driven stuff, like we said, jumping ahead to Gus Gorman just knows how to build a supercomputer. We'll accept that because we just want to get to the supercomputer and see what cool stuff it does. And certain movies that would just, I wouldn't let that slide, but tonally it just makes sense within this film for some reason. And I don't know if it's just that I'm bringing in certain expectations from Richard Lester's previous films, and it becomes a case of, you know, oh, you hate Superman 3? Well, watch these other films and you'll like it. It still doesn't mean Superman 3 is a success if it can't, I guess, exist on its own. But I do feel like that sort of context helps it quite a bit. If you understand that the person who made it actually has this rich filmography that informs the language of Superman 3, and that it's an unusual, I guess it's an unusual choice for a film like that, but for me it seems to make sense with Superman. Just the fact that Richard Lester is obsessed with these sort of icons, and, you know, Superman is pretty on par with the Beatles, I think, in terms of iconography and people's response to Superman. And you see hints of that throughout the film. The whole thing of Superman in the photo booth doing the costume change and handing off the picture to the kid, and even the idea of these loose visual connections of telephone booths. And I think of the Beatles in a telephone booth with a mask on.
In Hard Day's Night.
Right. So there's all of these. It makes sense. It might be on a weirdly shallow level, but it just makes sense that Richard Lester handles the Beatles films and Superman's films as these two major icons, and his sensibilities for me just work perfectly.
Yeah, I thought about Lester. I mean, you can sort of feel Lester's hand in the quieter moments, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, the big action sequences, even in Donner's original Superman, there's a kind of a final destination inevitability about the way things happen. The individual pieces that set up the helicopter dangling in the midpoint of the first film. Mm-hmm. It's incredible measured chaos. You know, oh, this nut is loose and this thing's going to happen and this cup of coffee might fall.
Right.
But in Superman 3, you know, as you say, he focuses on the characters in Smallville simply by being there with them. Mm-hmm. But I had never realized until last night that shot of Clark and Lana breaking down the party the next day is a wonder. Like, it's a single take.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly complicated. Mm-hmm. It just, I mean, it goes on for maybe 5 minutes and it's dialogue and someone's on a ladder and people get down and there are props to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. But it's also moving the story forward for the two characters. And it's doing so at a relaxed pace that instantly removes it from anything else in any Superman movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no portent. You know, previously all the Krypton stuff is so heavy and the dialogue is so elevated. And here it really is just two people talking about maybe going from the small town to the big city.
Yeah.
And maybe tentatively exploring the possibility of maybe having a relationship. Mm-hmm. It's all so sublimated, but it's so calm that we're allowed to breathe it. We're allowed to watch it happen with them. And it makes Annette O'Toole's performance just really way more important to the film than it might have otherwise been. Lana Lang becomes a person. Like, she's a mother. She's an adult. She's got regrets. Mm-hmm. She talks about everything that's gone on in her life. And you really do feel like this character who we glimpsed in the first movie is actually a person now. Like, she went on and had a life while Superman was being Superman.
Right. Yeah, I think that whole sequence is overlooked whenever people talk about Superman 3 because they're focused so much on Richard Pryor that the Smallville stuff is great. You're right in that it quiets down for a moment and you get... I think you get, in the first Superman film, and I guess in part two, you get some time between Clark and Lois, but there's always that, in two especially, the undercurrent is, okay, Superman's lost his powers, when is he going to get them back? Right. And that's all you're thinking about. And
You're not going to end the film on a cliffhanger where he's still Clark Kent, of course.
And so the relationship is only able to kind of breathe a little bit because there's that suspense underneath third. With this, it's just, we're going to spend some time in Smallville. We're going to see where Clark grew up and the relationships he had. And, you know, his relationship with Brad, I think, is interesting as well.
Yeah.
It's, you know, basic, but interesting.
And that actor had been, like, he was the sort of American douchebag to go to that year. He's in Superman 3 and in Never Say Never Again as well. Right. The heroin-addicted dupe.
Yeah, and he's in Willow as well.
That's right, a couple of years later. It was 5 years later?
Yeah.
But he was this strange go-to guy who doesn't seem to have existed outside of big genre pictures, which I find really interesting. As soon as I saw him in this one, it's like, oh, it's...
That guy.
Hitachi, I think his character's name was.
Yeah.
But once again, he's being used as just a complete buffoon. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was his thing, but it's so weird that he only surfaces in these movies. And maybe that's how kids recognize him, how, you know, children bond with the character.
Yeah. I mean, it's very efficient casting because you just put him in that role and you immediately understand who he is and you don't have to spend any additional time setting that up. So,
well, I mean, he predates Biff Tannen by 2 years, but it's the same archetype. It's the corn-fed idiot who peaked in high school.
Right. But even I just Lester's direction at the reunion. I love how when Clark and Lana first see each other and then it cuts to the images of the posters that are hanging up of their high school photos. And there's just a great sense of nostalgia there that it might not carry throughout the film. Like, we lose that pretty quickly. But for that sequence, it feels grounded. I think Lester said he wanted to make a film that felt more real. I don't know that it's a success in that regard, but there are moments that I think feel the most real out of the Superman films for me. And it would be those moments with Lana, even though their dialogue is very written and very playful, but it's a great relationship. And I haven't seen any of the Smallville TV show
I never really got into it.
So I don't know what, you know, where things go in terms of that relationship or how it's been dealt with in other ways in other shows, but I think it's great. And anything, again, for this film, I'm happy to just kind of, you know, have these contained moments, and then we get back to some of the playful superhero stuff, and it doesn't feel the need to, it kind of knows what its job is, I guess. Richard Lester is kind of just being efficient with the storytelling and with his visuals, and isn't trying to aim for the stars, but also is doing a great job at just setting up these fun action sequences. And I do think some of the action sequences are playful as well. Like the fire at
the chemical plant. Yeah.
And the idea of him taking the big tube and bending it down and everyone sliding down, just stuff like that is fun to watch. I mean, it's not, I don't know, it's very simple and but it's almost like, almost Jackie Chan-esque, like just watching these people slide down those tubes. I remember as a kid thinking, oh, that looks fun. I would love to be saved from a chemical fire and slide down a tube.
Yeah, I mean, the possibility of obliterating somehow the Eastern Seaboard, even though they're on their way to Kansas,
right.
It doesn't matter. It's a Superman movie. Yeah. But the problem with modern Superman movies, I mean, the execution in Man of Steel and Batman v Superman, DDS or LLP or whatever it is. I've been calling it Death of Joy just because I'm a dick. But the problem with Superman movies now is that the concept of Superman as a hero is so exaggerated now, in that he is a god on Earth. Mm-hmm. He's indestructible. So it always has to be either a Kryptonian or himself. Those are the only things that can harm him. And so what you get is, if he shows up, the fight scene's really over. Like, there's no... The emergency is simply, well, if the boat's on fire, I'm going to pick up the boat and move it somewhere where it's not on fire, or I'll blow it out, and it's over in a second.
Yeah.
What the earlier Superman movies did was they created, earthly complications that he has to deal with, but it also gives them inventive solutions. Like, Superman is allowed to be smart and resourceful, and by pulling up a giant duct and turning it into a slide, he diffuses the situation, but it also shows thought and caution, and, I can't just whip people off the side of this building and hope they land in the airbag. There's a process that's going through. Even in what was it? In Superman Returns, the wonderful sequence. And I go to the mattresses for Superman Returns. I think that it's a lovely film that was completely misunderstood and rejected because of the grimdark, the creeping grimdark of the X-Men movies and everything else. But there's a moment where Superman has to fly through Metropolis as glass is shattering and there's a giant earthquake or something, and he flips over on his back and uses his heat vision to remove the glass, to boil it away before it can fall on people. That's what Superman does.
Yeah.
Superman solves problems and saves people.
Mm-hmm.
And Superman 3 is all about that. But the cosmic risk, nobody is out to rule the world. The biggest inconvenience we see are people lining up at the pumps, which is just a reference to the energy crisis from like seven years earlier.
Yeah.
So here the stakes are really low. They are a greedy capitalist versus nothing in particular. We never find any, like, he doesn't have any competition. There really is nothing going on.
He just wants to control the coffee.
Yeah, and then the oil. And it's all pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that Superman's biggest battle is with himself is externalized and made kind of silly, because the junkyard fight is surprisingly inventive and also dumb at the same time, because it's Superman. You can put Clark Kent in a car crusher, but I'm pretty sure he's still invulnerable, and you're just annoying each other.
Mm-hmm.
But the stakes feel real because of the performance and because of the weird intensity of that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you follow Supergirl, the new TV series.
No, I don't.
Actually comes closest to capturing this. There was an episode. They've sort of leaned into the Donnerverse, the original Superman movie concepts, a little more heavily than, say, Batman v Superman does.
Right.
And there was an episode a couple of weeks ago where Kara was exposed to red kryptonite and did the whole thing. She ended up in a bar flicking peanuts at the wall.
Yeah.
And it was staged in this great little sequence where I watched it with Kate, who clearly was not familiar with Superman 3, and when she picked up the peanuts, I just sort of leaned forward and went, no. And they did it, and it was just joyful.
Mm-hmm.
It was still mean and cruel, but it was a connection to that material that I thought we lost. And I've been saying this for a couple of weeks since Batman v Superman opened. If you want to see what Superman is supposed to be, why everybody is upset. If you don't understand why people are annoyed at Man of Steel and Batman v Superman, take a look at Supergirl. That is the idea of someone who is secretly magnificent living among humans, as opposed to the Zack Snyder vision of Superman, which is, you know, Clark Kent's not really that important. Superman is above us, literally, figuratively, morally. We cannot judge him. We should just hope he's there when we need him.
Right.
And Lester, as you say, like, he's there for you all the time. Even if you don't see him, he's still thinking about you.
Yeah.
And that's, there's a grace there and a sort of a pleasant, warm feeling of Superman that has gotten lost along the way.
Yeah, and that's what's threatened in this film when he starts to turn. And I love that they phrase it as he's become normal.
Yeah.
He's not evil, he's just normal.
Yeah.
And these are the impulses that he's feeling. I guess because, you know, he's been so inherently good for so long that once he becomes normal, he just has sex, gets drunk, flicks peanuts, and straightens the Leaning Tower of Pizza. Yeah. But
that is the most wonderful thing. And I know that it's just a joke for Lester so he can set up the punchline at the end.
Right.
And there is a kind of a weird English laugh at the foreigner moment in that scene.
Yeah.
In both scenes. The untranslated, you know, whiny, complaining Italian novelty salesman. But that feels... it feels like something that somebody would do if given incredible power and you were just really cranky. There's a weird sense that of all the things that Superman could screw up, like he's not carving his own face on Mount Rushmore. He's not, you know, writing his name on the concrete anywhere. He's not humiliating people. He's just screwing with a monument. Because, you know, that should be straight. Which still kind of speaks to his own sense of order in a really weird way. It's like the one thing he always wanted to do, but he couldn't correct it because that would be wrong. But is it really wrong if you're Superman?
Yeah, they're always asking him to fix things, and so he fixes the one thing that they don't want fixed. Yeah.
And really, nobody seems terribly upset about it. There's still a tourism industry about it, as we see.
Yeah.
Maybe the, you know, the straightened little tower figurines could have maybe had a little Superman sticking out of one side just to, so they could commemorate the straightening.
But I would think he would sell more.
Right? He's not hurting. He's helping.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, that sort of visual gag, it, I mean, I almost, it just gets back to his sort of montage-y, playful style from the Beatles films, and you can almost imagine John Lennon walking up in a forced perspective and leaning on it it going straight, or it's that same sort of tone, but
it's a look. Like it's a kind of a joyful, prankish spirit as opposed to something genuinely cruel.
Right. And I mean, getting back to the idea of him, his responsibilities, and you know, he's when he's with Lana and there's that moment where he's on the couch and he's kind of making a pass at her and she's talking about the bridge and this idea that, and he's not fully turned yet, but even as an audience member, you're like, ooh, that's creepy.
Superman is sitting uncomfortably close to Lana Lang.
Right.
You can feel that scene in the blocking of it. It's
just in, it's just him sitting on the couch next to her
in
makes
costume.
You judge him and think he's being a creep. And it's like, so Superman's not even allowed to sit next to a woman on a couch? Like, you know, he's got this responsibility, and he's this figure, this icon, and even just him sitting next to someone on a couch breaks that in a way. And you start to think, like, okay, well, he's turning normal, he's got these urges, but eventually he comes back to being who he is, which means that he just isn't allowed to experience any of those things in that way, I guess. And it's almost like maybe it's just me, I feel almost a little bad for him. Now it's back to just taking care of the lemmings and making sure everybody's not walking off of cliffs. And but yeah, I mean, that sort of perspective on Superman for me is interesting. It's more interesting than the God that's indestructible. And Lester did it in part two as well with the fight in Metropolis. With Zod and the other guys, and that fight is more about protecting the citizens than actually battling these people. So they recognize his weakness, which is his love for these people and wanting to protect them. So they're just trying to, you know, crush people with cars, and all he does is sort of deflect all of those things. And that to me is, it's like, I guess it's just, there's a lot more opportunity for some fun action sequences when it's not just people punching each other and whoever has the harder punch wins. Right. It's the strategy of being able to clean up all of these messes and keep everything contained and in order and making sure that nobody dies in this case, let alone, like, if one person died in that fight in Superman 2, you feel like Superman would quit.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's that scene earlier on where Zod kills a child. I mean, right. It's off camera, yeah. But it's there. Mm-hmm. And it very quickly establishes that these guys are the bad guys. They're yeah. worse than, I mean, they're somehow worse than Luthor, who detonated two nuclear weapons at the end of the first Superman. And that's something else that I keep coming back to about the new Superman is that mm-hmm. people don't care about the carnage, about the surrounding disaster, because that's what filmmakers think the audience wants from these movies. Mm-hmm. The same way almost every Marvel movie ends with a big thing falling out of the sky onto some stuff.
Yeah.
It's just, that's the formula.
Yeah.
So with the Donner Superman films and with the Lester Superman half film and film, you have a world where every decision is thought through, and it's how, if Superman can kill you with a punch, he can't punch you. Mm-hmm. So it has to be something else. There yeah. has to be another way. And that's why the fight in Niagara Falls in Superman 2 lands so hard, because Christopher Reeve plays it, like, he freaks out, which is so fantastic. It's the one thing that was really surprising in Man of Steel that they didn't echo in any way. There is a scene where Superman gets bloodied for the first time, and mm-hmm. presumably ever. Mm-hmm. And the idea that Reeve's Clark is paralyzed by this sight of his own blood is so human and alien at the same time mm-hmm. that it's just so magical in a really weird way, and it suddenly makes the character feel more real mm-hmm. because all of a sudden he's not the caricature of fear that Clark Kent will sometimes project. He's actually afraid.
Yeah.
And in 3, he's gotten beyond that, so they have to find another challenge, which mm-hmm. is have him arguing with himself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it still somehow turns it into, like, it's not a movie about all the oil in the world being threatened. It's not a movie about computers taking over. It's a movie about Superman not being able to do what Superman needs to do.
Yeah. And
it's a movie about the stakes of being Superman, mm-hmm. which is something that, I mean, clearly that's no longer an issue. That's right. not what people want to see.
Yeah.
But I wanted to see it, and I still care about that stuff because it makes the character who is absolutely unrelatable, relatable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know. Again, I don't know exactly what Superman fans want yeah, from Superman.
I'm saying it's unfair to put this on you because you're not as invested as I am.
For me, I guess.
But if this is your Superman, then this is what you would want, right?
This is what I want, and I again, it probably falls, at least now. My reaction to it as a kid was just, this is fun. It's colorful. It's inventive. It's weirdly dark at times as well, tonally, like the junkyard fight. I remember that sticking out as a kid. I think I probably felt it went on a little long, and it does go on a little long. Mm. But again, after watching, you know, Help and Hard Day's Night and Lester's filmography, and seeing how he, you know, he's a cinematic storyteller, and he's not in many cases a literalist. Like, he's using images to get across ideas, and it makes me watch that junkyard sequence and just think, this is a almost attempted suicide. Like, it's,
yeah, no, he's choking himself. Like, he is.
Yeah. And the setting is the setting because it's interesting and fun to watch, but I'm not sure I take it completely literally when he splits apart and fights himself, and it's in that setting. It just feels like an inventive way to kind of get a suicide scene into a blockbuster superhero movie.
Right.
And I guess that's how you do it. But yeah, I mean, beyond that, it's just the way that he will set up these set pieces, and, you know, even the frozen lake thing, I can't say for sure what comes from him and what comes from the writers, but the way he presents these solutions are just way more satisfying and fun than brute force, yeah. or, you know, not to continually just bash the Zack Snyder version of Superman.
No. But this is a safe space. You go right ahead.
But I will you know, take that sense of fun. I know for some reason, a lot of people seem to be against the idea of injecting fun into something. As a result of the Superman versus Batman thing, I guess they are doing reshoots on the Suicide Squad.
Yeah, apparently they want to make it more comic.
And then the response is like, why would we want more fun in this? And my response is, why wouldn't you want more fun? I mean, there are just certain movies that I think are set out to do certain jobs. And Superman 3, the job that Richard Lester set out to accomplish, I think he accomplished extremely well. And it's just a matter of whether or not you feel that, I guess, it's an appropriate way of telling a Superman story.
Right.
And seeing as I have no real investment in Superman, I'm more at this point invested in seeing a Richard Lester film. I think it's probably a minor Richard Lester film, but he still finds his way through the material, and it still creates something that's weird. It's entertaining, but it's got these strange tonal shifts, and it's got these set pieces that are inventive and visually interesting to watch, and but still has those small moments in small town where you're grounded in certain ways with the characters. I think Richard Pryor's character, I like him. He's an interesting kind of, like, I want him to succeed, even though he's taking sort of the wrong path, but, he's still kind of a interesting character for the lead of a superhero film, I guess.
I mean, he is definitely not a villain.
Right.
Even though he does things that are selfish and self-interested, he certainly, the fact that, 15 years later, they could make a joke about it in Office Space about channeling all the half-cents and stealing that plot point.
Yeah.
But there's a weird sort of naivete to everything he does, including a villain plan to help the bad guy get all the oil. You know, I think Robert Vaughn knows exactly what kind of tone he should be hitting.
Yeah.
He's this sort of gleeful, evil rapaciousness to him, to everything he does. There's that weird little moment about how I can't have anyone with me who isn't with me. But there's so much strange confidence in that line delivery, which is basically nonsensical, that you don't mind. And then you can sort of see why Gus would want to hang out with this guy, and then gradually realize that he's doing all the work and getting no reward. And then his arc is completely organic, given that he barely exists as a character.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of, like, he's basically a henchman.
Right.
He's Alan Cumming in Goldeneye. He's the guy at the table who doesn't really factor into the story until he gets angry or gets killed. And focusing on him is a really interesting way into the world of Metropolis, where these guys, presumably, like, they're supervillains and they're henchmen and their entire structures for that. And this is how that starts. This is how you get a job as a henchman.
Right.
And I can see how at the script stage that would be really interesting. I mean, I would love to pursue that and follow it down that rabbit hole. And also, you have to make a Superman movie. So as a result, he kind of gets short shrift. But there's stuff going on that's... Yeah, clearly only someone who's really interested in characters and behavior would come up with this in the first place.
Right. And I mean, with him being naive, it is funny. The moment where he lays out the plans for the supercomputer kind of comes out of nowhere. Like, it was a stretch to think that this guy that we know nothing about, we meet him in an unemployment line, and then we realize, okay, he's a computer programming genius just for some reason.
Yeah, even he doesn't know how.
Right.
But he is.
And then suddenly we take the next step where he's now designed a supercomputer that will change the world. But on top of that, he's presenting it to this guy that is essentially a supervillain in a weird way. But when he presents it, he's like, it'll do anything I want it to do, anything I ask it to do. And it's almost like he's thinking, it'll, you know, fetch my beer, or will, like, print money, and he's presenting it with no idea that maybe it might be dangerous to put it in the hands of this, you know, this villain. And then when he finds out they're using it to trap Superman and kill him, he's suddenly surprised, like, oh, the supercomputer I designed might be used for evil, which is kind of funny. But ultimately, all of those logic leaps fall apart once I get to see the computer and Superman interacting with it.
Yeah.
If that wasn't as fun to watch, then it would have been a failure. But I don't know, within the context of this film, some of that stuff As I said before, I'll let it slide so that I don't have to sit with an additional 20 minutes just to motivate how he knows how to program a computer. And it's just not that film.
Yeah. And it's the DNA of, you know, any mega franchise project, right? We don't need to watch them build this month's stronghold in the Bond movie. It'll be there.
Right.
When we get there, it's there. And here, yeah, I mean, the computer stuff I would love to know how it plays to children now who have grown up with tablets and who've never had to think about programming languages or anything like that. And if any of it is even important, or if it's just that, oh, that computer takes over that lady and it's really disturbing.
Right.
Like, if that lands, you're right, nothing else matters as long as we have something for Superman to fight against.
I think it's broad enough. The strokes are broad enough that it's still, it's cartoony enough that it works, because they're not even really attempting to root it in a reality. So it's not like watching The Net,
right?
Where, you know, we're seeing her order a pizza online and it's like that
was revolutionary in 1985. We have to ooh and ah at all the things that are possible.
Right.
I mean, even now, if you tried that storyline, it would have to turn into Brainiac. It would have to be a precursor to another super character that we know from the existing lexicon. So we can think, oh, it's part of a master plan. Nope, it's just a computer. Goes crazy. Bad things happen.
And we would learn way more than we need to learn about how it works. And,
sure. The phrase neural net would be thrown around.
Yeah.
Like all the stuff they used in Terminator, because now we know what that sounds like.
Right.
We know what to expect.
Yeah.
But when you're breaking the ground of having an incidental menace in a Superman movie that isn't going to make it past this film, it's, you can be less concerned and it can still land. It can still work in the moment because, we care about it because Superman is being hurt by it. That's all that really matters.
Yeah. And then just getting to see how he resolves that problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's just on that simple level, extremely entertaining. And then if you want to, you know, dig beyond that, I do find it interesting still that when Superman becomes evil and they word it as him becoming normal, that it kind of suggests that his good nature is contrary to the way people are, you know,
like his greatest superpower is his sense of morality.
Right. And you remove that and he's just another asshole, I guess. And it does, you know, it doesn't really linger on that, but it's kind of there.
Yeah. And we do sort of see it in Superman 2 as well, where he goes back to beat up the bully.
Right.
Superman or as a superpowered Clark Kent.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I get it. It's for the kids in the audience who really wish they could stand up to a bully, and it's a power fantasy. But at the same time, it's like, boy, Superman wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Like, he really would not do that. He'd find another way to humiliate the guy.
Right.
But that's not who you are. And then you see this, and it's like, oh, it is, though. Like, that's there.
Yeah.
The seed was planted.
Yeah, and I mean, to that, the I guess, disconnect of Superman 3 from 1 and 2... I kind of like as well, just that it doesn't seem as huge as those two movies, and it feels like its own thing.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be cosmic. It's no longer indebted or beholden to the Kryptonian stuff.
Right.
Neither Jor-El nor Lara is there. He's just moved on with his life.
And I think that kind of allows a bit of that tonal difference from those other two films. I guess if it just carried on along that story thread and suddenly all of this comedic stuff was injected in, it would be a little tougher to swallow. But because it feels like a separate entry, it almost has its own logic and doesn't really, you know, there's the kind of awkward dealing of Lois Lane, which I guess was some contract dispute with Margot Kidder.
But wanted to do it at all.
Right. And which I, from what I understand, came from Lester coming on and Donner being kicked off, and there was this allegiance to Donner and some tensions. But the way they handle that is quite obvious, that, you know, we'll send Lois on vacation and she'll be out of the picture. But, you know, beyond that and the casting of Pryor as some weird cash grab, I think it's a solid film. Like, it's especially after watching a bunch of films and his filmography and ending on that one and thinking, well, for someone who started in this very unique, almost avant-garde realm.
Yeah.
And then to be pulled into Hollywood, it could have been worse.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I love Juggernaut, I like the Three Musketeers and Four Musketeers, and I think Superman 3, I actually prefer Superman 3 to 2. It's my favorite film, but I can see why people like 1 and 2 more, but as just a pure Richard Lester experience, it's very interesting. And I when they did the Donner cut of 2, I found all the stuff that was my favorite moments were lifted out from the Donner cut, and it was like, oh, those are a lot of the Lester moments.
Yeah, I mean, I can appreciate the Donner cut, but you can also, unfortunately, it's impossible to watch it now without undoing the first Superman as well, because mm-hmm. of the ending thing and the way they were going the way they had to readjust everything because of the plan of shooting the two films together, or mm-hmm. almost together. I prefer the Lester cut. I mean, it's probably because it's the one I saw when I was 12 and when I needed it to be Superman.
Yeah.
But I'm still, it's happier and it's less severe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of okay with that. I don't actually mind an upbeat Superman, especially now. I feel like I've been proven right that the way forward is literally up for Superman. He flies. You're supposed to have fun with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I mean, just the idea of going back into 2 and hiring actors to try to replicate voices and doing some half-baked CG work to try to fill in these holes. And
I mean, that stuff dates it more than anything from 1981.
Yeah, it fulfills a curiosity, but as a film, it's non-existent for me. It's just a special edition Blu-ray, and that's it.
Right.
But I was just, you know, surprised when I watched that, and all of the stuff that I kind of remembered from Superman 2 was gone. And I guess it's just, you know, when you listen to Richard Donner's commentary, and he has some oddly disparaging words for Lester, and of course, because he was replaced, but it makes you realize that I guess Superman 3 must have had played a big role in Richard Lester's career just dropping off. I mean,
yeah, it probably did more to, I mean, he was also getting older, but
right. I had read, I think for the I haven't actually seen it, but is it the Musketeers Return? He did another Musketeers movie
Return
in the 80s.
Musketeers in 89, yeah.
And I think there was an accident and someone fell off of a horse or something and died, and that apparently had a big effect on him stopping as well, but his cachet was, I think, kind of gone after Superman 3, which is unfortunate, because this is a guy who made these films that had this influence that not many people seem to acknowledge. And I think a lot of people don't even realize that the guy who directed Superman 3 directed A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah.
And once you realize that, then 3 makes sense. But I don't know. I'm not going to just go on a lifelong goal to... You know,
you're evangelizing it.
Right, right.
I mean, there are worse things to do than force people to watch A Hard Day's Night.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I also, you know, it's not like I'm saying Superman 3 is on par with A Hard Day's Night.
Sure.
And it's a different kind of film, but contextually, I just like what he brought to it.
Yeah.
And it'd be great if, you know, it was... I guess, especially now with superhero films being so popular, it was a part of the conversation a little more, and not just set aside as, this is not the type of film we could do ever again.
Right.
Like, I guess Guardians of the Galaxy and Ant-Man are the closest.
Yeah, that, Deadpool, although it's much more of a hard R kind of thing.
Yeah.
The sense of fun and play.
Yeah.
And the sense that the audience is familiar enough with the tropes that you can tweak them.
Yeah.
Certainly, I'm ready for that every time.
Yeah.
It just never happens.
Yeah.
And then which brings us to the final question of the show, which is, what of it have you borrowed or lifted or stolen or absorbed into your DNA? How has Superman 3 stayed with you in your work?
Well, I recently can point literally to a moment, and I'm shooting a short documentary right now, about a tornado that hit a local drive-in where I live. During Twister, while Twister was playing.
Okay.
And it didn't actually happen. It's an urban legend, but there's a lot of confusion as to what exactly happened that night. And we filmed some recreations of the night of the storm. And I specifically wanted my Superman 3 Richard Lester moment where someone walks outside of the concession stand into a windstorm holding popcorn, and the popcorn flies everywhere and they try to walk against the wind.
Right.
That's my Richard Lester nod, I guess. But I mean, other than that, I just, his sensibilities, cutting wise even, although I haven't really incorporated any of that into my work.
Mm-hmm. Just, well, How to Build a Time Machine is much more sort of self-consciously Kubrickian in its cutting and its Steadicam and even its font.
Yeah.
But there's a sense of, there's a weird sense of melancholy that comes through here and there. And that sort of, I kind of felt that in the Smallville scenes watching Superman 3 this time, just thinking about how that might have bounced around in your head.
Well, there's definitely nostalgia in both films and reconnecting to the past. But if I were to think, and I, in no way am I saying this actually influenced anything, but going back to the idea of just visuals that are somehow satisfying to watch. In How to Build a Time Machine, a chunk of the movie is a guy literally building a time machine. Yeah. Prop.
The time machine.
Yeah. And just watching him mix the silicone and pour it into a mold and trim the edges of the mold. And that sort of stuff I enjoy watching. We'll see if other people do.
Right.
But you get mesmerized by that. And so choosing these visuals that have some sort of weird psychological connection where you're not sure why you like watching this, but you could watch it forever.
Right.
There's a moment where he's picking a stencil off of his dish, and I feel like I could watch him just pick little pieces of that stencil off forever. And Superman 3 taps into that where, you know, when he puts all of the oil back into the tanker and is folding it up and welding the seams. There's something satisfying about watching him do that, and choosing those types of scenarios and visualizing them in that way, I think just heightens the film cinematically. It's not just, you know, simply people punching and flying and kicking and explosions. There's a playfulness to the scenarios, and there's a satisfaction to watching him. I guess comes back to, I think David Mamet said something about this, the idea of watching people who are really good at their jobs, doing their jobs well.
Right.
And I love that. So in my film, I'm watching a craftsman making a time machine, and it's satisfying because he's a perfectionist and he's really good at what he does. And with Superman, it's the same thing. He's really good at saving people, and I enjoy watching him do it. And you almost feel like, well, it must get boring to just fly up and grab people off of a roof, so why not use this pipe as a slide?
Yeah.
Like, it's like his creative flourishes as he's saving people.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of fun, and maybe it kind of bleeds over into Time Machine, not directly, but that's kind of a connection, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly they're both, I mean, with Superman, there's definitely more of an assurance that when this mission is done, when this thing is done, this job of work, everything is going to be okay.
Yeah.
And with Time Machine, that's sort of the goal.
Right.
Once I'm finished, I'll be whole.
Yeah, yeah.
And the question is if you're ever going to be finished.
Right,
I suppose.
Right. Yeah. I guess now that Superman is off of having sex and getting drunk and flicking peanuts and back to saving people, he will never be finished with that job.
It's a long road.
Yeah, yeah.
My thanks to Jay Cheel, whose new movie, How to Build a Time Machine, premieres in Toronto at the Hot Docs Festival on Monday, May 2nd, and screens again on Tuesday, May 3rd, and Saturday, May 7th. Check facebook.com/timemachinedoc, all one word, to see if tickets are still available for any of those screenings. You can also find Jay's earlier documentary, Beauty Day, on iTunes, and of course you can catch him on the regular on his Film Junk podcast. You can find Jay on Twitter at jcheel, all one word, and you can find Superman 3 on Blu-ray and DVD from Warner Brothers Home Entertainment. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. And if you want to leave a review on iTunes, this week's call sign is The Philly Flash. Thanks for listening.